I'd come close to bringing it up when we had our discussion about one organization ruling the world. My business in Peru at this time had two aspects. One was to promote movies for a motion picture company, but I was also there on another assignment, to gather journalistic information from the South American press wires and from my connections in Peru, reporting my findings to one man. On October 3, 1968, General Juan Velasco Alvarado took command of the presidency of Peru as a military junta. Since that time, the relations between this country and the United States had been going downhill, both diplomatically and in business matters. I'd been doing public relations work for some large New York corporations since 1970, using my connections to help solve some of the conflicts, in order to preserve their investments in Peru. When I met Rama, I already knew of the existence of this centralized corporation, which has subsidiaries all over the world. I was working for that corporation. One letter of the alphabet, 1, representing international, symbolized this company. I knew the name of only one man within that organization, a man who was world-renowned. I knew he was with a top-secret consolidation, which had been headquartered in Lima, Peru, for years. This was the man I reported to. He sent me all over the world on some very heavy assignments. He trusted me, knowing I would act in good faith. When I began accepting assignments from him, it was difficult for me to believe that people and organizations like the Mission Impossible team really existed. But, as time went on, I realized they did exist. I began to see how the manipulation of both business and government is in the hands of this international conglomerate, headed by one giant corporation, and that its power was in the hands of one man. This man, the head of an international firm, had connections in key government jobs in many countries. I was the liaison between this international setup and foreign governments because of my diverse cultural upbringing, and my fluency in languages, which enabled me to comfortably function in many parts of the world. After we were settled in my room, I told Rama about the man I worked for. I explained that my work for this man and the international firm he represented was one of the reasons I'd been reluctant to get involved with her project. I would have to answer questions from too many people, businesses, and governments. Matter-of-factly, Rama said, the man you work for will be assassinated by the end of 1975. Her response was unexpected and shocking. I stared at her, speechless. If there was one man I trusted in this world, he was the man. To hear Rama say he would be dead in a year and a half was hard to take. Even though I'd come to respect her psychic abilities, it was unbelievable, and painful to think she could be right. It bothered me that she would say something like that. Without further discussion of the subject, we both went to bed and fell asleep almost immediately. I woke up at 5 in the morning and turned over. Rama was gone. Since I was wide awake, I decided to get up, pack, and get an early start driving back to Lima. I began thinking about what Rama had said the night before. When I'd left the office last Friday, there had been certain indications that trouble might be starting, but not quite as serious as Rama seemed to think. And certainly not serious enough to extend my stay in Peru. I couldn't wait to get back to the office to see what had developed. I was indeed curious. Chapter 10. The Education of a Believer. It had been over a month before I could go back into the Andes Mountains to see Rama again. Just as she had predicted, the day I arrived back in Lima I was asked by my people in the United States to make arrangements for my supervisor to fly to Lima, Peru. I had been astounded by the accuracy of her prediction. This, of course, blew my July 15th court appearance. I did what I could to work out another court date, because when I failed to appear, I knew a warrant for my arrest would automatically be issued and I would be arrested as soon as I set foot in California. On July 18th, my supervisor arrived in Lima to straighten out the mess created by some of our Peruvian investors. To complicate matters even further, on July 27th, the Peruvian government took over the news media, slapping tight censorship control over all television, newspaper and magazine reporting of the news events. Even worse, a curfew was put into effect and the military police began to stop and question foreigners. Finally, on August 7, my supervisor returned to the United States. He requested that I stay in Peru for at least another 2 months to ensure our business interests in Peru went as planned. My biggest problem was with our Peruvian investors, a bunch of hardheads who could turn the smallest assignment into a complicated mess. Everyone was haggling over the casting and credits for the movie. The whole situation was extremely difficult and depressing. During this time, I managed to find some time to do a great deal of reading, and practice my astral projection. I asked my people in the United States to send me several books and other related material on astral travel and UFOs. They sent me Raymond Drake's Gods and Spacemen in the Ancient West. After reading this book, just as Rama had said, I no longer believed it was impossible that she could be from another world. The book gave so much detailed information corresponding to my experiences with Rama that I couldn't wait to get back to the Andes Mountains and talk to her again. I had a lot of questions and I wanted answers. On Friday, August 9th, at about 5:30 in the afternoon, I got into my rented car and drove back to Acaya. I felt very tired and somewhat depressed, so I went straight to bed. The next morning, I had breakfast and, since it was Saturday, I had to wait in line for my turn to get into the baths. To my surprise, Rama was already there, waiting for me. "How did you know I was there?" I asked, even though I already knew the answer. "Well, I always do. I sense you're coming. Remember, I'm very close to your thoughts. I know your intentions. Since yesterday afternoon you've been thinking about coming here. And you were brooding over your luck in Peru. How did you know all this was going to happen? You knew I was going to have to stay in Peru, that my supervisor was coming to Lima, that we were going to have this mess. How did you know about the political situation? You accurately forecasted the future. It's difficult for me to believe you did it. You keep forgetting what I'm telling you about the third force. I not only sensed your feelings, your reasons for coming here, and when you would be here, I was also able to sense the intentions and thinking of the people around you. How could you sense the intentions of our Peruvian investors? How did you know they were a bunch of schmucks? That's easy. First of all, you already knew they weren't keeping their word, isn't that correct? Yes. But how did you know my supervisor was coming? I had no idea about that. The same way. By the connection with what you did know. When you left the United States, you were told that should there be any complications, not to hesitate to call them and let them know exactly what was happening. That way, your supervisor would come if you needed him. When you sent your reports, I knew they would consider it necessary to send someone to help you. And they did. Yes, but I keep asking myself, how did you know these things? I guess this is the proof I've been looking for, that you are what you claim to be. Look, Chicho, it was no different than the gypsy woman reading your palm for $3.50 at the Santa Monica Pier. Since your predictions were true, I must believe that everything else you tell me is true. The gypsy lady didn't tell me she was from another planet. And she was only 85% accurate. So far, your predictions have been true in every case. Your reading of my past has been just as true and faithful, not only to the facts of my life, but also in terms of your interpretation of the whole series of events that have led me to this point of time in my life. Rama, I'm beginning to realize, perhaps for the first time, just what an extraordinary person you are. I believe you, and I love you, despite our interplanetary differences. I want to know more about you. Where you come from? How long you've been here? Everything. I want to know about you. And about the world you come from. Okay, Chicho. First I want you to realize that what is natural in this universe is often the most wondrous surprise. You think of my being from another planet as something unnatural, an impossible phenomenon. But I come from a world in this very solar system. It's not very far from here, considering that space travel extends beyond the conglomeration of galaxies comprising the cosmic unit of which we both are a part. I am here in this world because I have a serious mission. I am a messenger. While I'm here, I look like you, and dress like you. We're from another part of the universe. We've been traveling through these vast dimensions since the beginning of recorded history. The Bible is an ancient record of visitations to Earth by extraterrestrials. These visits have been misrepresented due to the limited understanding of the people who received the messages given by earlier astronauts. Visits from outer space to your Earth during the last few centuries can compare with an ocean liner that travels to a faraway island once or twice a year to trade with the natives. The same type of thing is happening today. Spacemen and women are scattered all over your world. Since you believe now, and no, I'm not trying to con you into something, it'll be a lot easier for us to work together to accomplish the mission. I guess you're right. Remember what Jesus told his disciples in John, chapter 5? Apostrophe. But these things I say that ye might be saved. The reason I've chosen you to do this job for us, to be the person responsible for transmitting our message and plant this seed, is because I can sense your developmental processes. I know you're going to become more aware, disciplined in your will, and that your motives are sincere. That's the way we do it on our planet. We're honest with ourselves. We love ourselves. Since we understand God as the Force, no one would go into someone else's house thinking of stealing, killing, or doing harm. As soon as we enter someone's home, they sense our presence. They are in tune with us, with our vibrations, our ananas and anionites. That is known as perfect harmony. Thus, we can and do live with each other in peace. What is your world called? The Kingdom of the Mount. It's where I've lived for more than 304 of your terrestrial years. In this solar system, it's called Ganymede, one of the moons of Jupiter. It's about the size of your moon. Our terrain is very much like the one we're on right now. The atmosphere is about the same, very thin oxygen, with high, steep mountains covered with ice, as is the case here. The topography is also very similar. Incredible. I know about the moons of Jupiter, but it seems unlikely that life exists on one of them. We have extremely cold weather compared to your temperatures. But for us, these temperatures are comfortable. What about your way of life? Do you get married? Do you have movie theaters? Is it a paradise? We live in the valleys, surrounded by the icy peaked mountains, in small complexes, what you would call villages. Similar to the ones you see around here. Ganymede is very volcanic. Volcanoes are our source of energy, and we use that powerful energy for our technology. The same way you usually find large cities like New York, Paris, London, and Rome clustered near large bodies of water, our villages and industrial centers are near volcanoes. They are our source of life. We have no oceans or large rivers on our planet. We get our water from the melting ice mixed with the volcanic heat. It's very similar to the medicinal waters you find right here. Is the volcanic energy used for heat as well? Yes, the volcanoes contain a great deal of thermal energy, which we use to maintain healthy temperatures. Since we have no rivers or oceans, and extreme temperatures, we have no animals on our planet, only mineral, vegetable and human forms of life. In our world we've adapted to this. We don't need animals for food. Besides, eating and absorbing the ananas and anionites of animals puts microorganisms into our systems, creating toxins in the body. That's where you Earth inhabitants get your common cold and other illnesses. I've heard about this. It's the vegetarian philosophy and basis for their lifestyle. This is hot stuff. Tell me more. What about your cities? Do you have large cities? No. Nothing at all like your big cities. We don't use such methods of construction, and our materials are different. We have lots of seismic movement. Earthquakes are natural in a place where there is so much volcanic activity. You people make your cities grow towards the sky. We go several levels underneath. Our structures are in cylindrical form, with one main shaft onto which other cylindrical structures can be interfaced if expansion is required. The additional cylinders are clustered around the main shaft and are connected to it. These underground buildings also function to modify the seismic activity of our world. What about government? What is your economy like? Who rules? I know what you mean, but give me a more specific question. Well, do you have countries? No, we have no boundaries on Ganymede. It's enough to tell you that we need no armies or police. I spoke of this before, so I won't elaborate except to say that it would be useless to have policemen or armies when everybody knows what everybody else is thinking, right? Right. What about religion? Religion on our planet is, in essence, the same doctrine of love and brotherhood taught some 2,000 years ago by a man named Jesus Christ. He was someone very special, a guide. We're going to talk about him more, but not right now. Let's leave him for later when we make a link with Jesus as someone from far away, from another world. Aren't you going a bit too far with this? Can you imagine me telling my future readers that Jesus Christ got out of a UFO? No way. You're so screwed up with this Jesus concept that every time you even hear the name mentioned, your adrenaline rises. Let's be peaceful about all this. I'm asking you to give it a fair chance, just as you did with the idea of UFOs. Remember when Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this earth"? We're going to study that phrase. What I'm trying to tell you now is that in our world we practice the same teachings as the early Christians. I wouldn't call that religion, because we don't go to church and pray to idols, or to a tortured man on a cross. We act. We are love, we feel it, sense it, breathe it. This is the fundamental basis of our religion, it's more or less a state of being. We do have our spiritual guides, those who take care of our spiritual guidance in space. Remember in Catholic school, when you learned about the saints? I nodded affirmatively. Here in Latin America, Mexico, Spain and Italy, devotion is instilled concerning patron saints. It's a custom, a tradition, to believe that each person is his or her own patron saint, remember? Yes, I remember, like Saint Jude, the patron saint of the impossibles. Right. A guide in the universe. People think of him and pray to him. It's a way of getting in touch with a higher mind. What you're doing is projecting your ananas and anionites, getting in tune with the saint through the thought form known here as prayer. For us, prayer is being at peace with ourselves, and projecting our thoughts, making images of what we would like to do. In your case, you might want a beautiful penthouse in Rome. So you would start thinking about that penthouse, how it would look, giving it shape, color and design. By doing that, and by developing your ability to control the third force, you begin to create just by thinking. Remember when you were learning about astral projection, you first studied about it by reading. Then you projected your thoughts. It's a chemical process. The mind secretes thoughts the way a gland secretes fluid. This is pure science. Haven't you read about the thinking and learning processes being a chemical reaction? I remember the test where worms that had been trained to perform certain tricks were eaten by untrained worms. After eating them, they were able to perform almost the same functions without being trained. That's the idea. Here's how it works. Inside your brain, there's a gland. It's called the pineal gland, or the third eye. This gland creates light in the darkness of the mind by secreting a substance we'll call anions and cations. One substance, two names, because as soon as it is secreted as one force and hits the pineal gland, it divides into two elements. These elements of thought, anions and cations, are projected from your brain into space, mixing with the ananas and anionites. As you begin thinking about and desiring a penthouse in Rome, you begin taking steps toward achieving that goal. If you continue to do this, you will eventually have it. A dream, a thought, a wish, eventually materializes like an answer to prayer. The beautiful thing about this is that when you finally master this technique, you no longer want a penthouse. That's what concentration does for you, though. It makes your wishes come true. You're telling me that when I master this force, I can make my wishes come true? That's exactly what I'm saying. But in order to get to that point, you have to be sincere and peaceful in your own being. If having that penthouse in Rome doesn't harm your fellow human beings, there's not one cosmic reason why your dream shouldn't come true. Rama, you mentioned spiritual guides. Are your spiritual guides like rabbis and priests? Yes, I suppose you could call them that. They're people who give us spiritual guidance. Each one of us gets a scientific explanation for every, what you would call here, religious teaching, except that our religious practices have more correspondence with things like metaphysics, theosophy. Do you remember Madame Blavatsky? The name sounds familiar, I said. She was the founder of the Theosophical Society and the author of a book known as The Secret Doctrine. Madame Blavatsky was very much on the ball. She understood God as a third force. And, in her time, she said it. I wouldn't say proved it, but she used it, and she used it in good faith. And because of this, she was persecuted and vilified. People made her out to be a know-nothing lady, a con, a witch. Same thing with Lobsang Rangpa. These people had no mean intentions when they brought their doctrines out, it was more or less their way of saying, hey, look, this is the truth, do you want to take it? You want to become immortal, to live forever? You want to astral travel? That's more like our religion. Our priests, if you wish to call them that, are spiritual guides who cultivate our spirits. They don't interfere with our everyday lives. They teach us no mysteries, only cosmic laws. They use scientific methods, like the method I used to teach you about ananas and ananites. That's the way we teach our children. From the time they're old enough to understand, they're not taught to think of God as someone with a human form the way you people on Earth do. We don't have any rituals. There's no veneration to any kind of idol. Sometimes we get together with certain ones who are more advanced. Then we participate in more advanced studies. That calls for a celebration, but nothing mandatory, as you have here in your world. In general, the sun is the cosmic source of inspiration in our system. That's where the teachings come from, the same teachings as found in the Egyptian, Incan, Persian, Mayan, and Aztec cultures. In the books you've read, you can clearly see where von Däniken and others speak about these divinities coming from heaven. When it comes to religion, we're going to make a parallel comparison between your religion and ours. All the great civilizations have always catered to the sun as a source of religious inspiration. When you study the teachings of the Incas, the Persians, the Aztecs, the Tibetan Lamas, the Mayans, you'll find they all have one thing in common, that this third force is God. That's what we call the intelligent force in the universe, the greatest teacher, the God of love, of forgiveness, the path of light, the truth of life. This is already known here on your planet, through metaphysics and astral projection. Lobsang Rangpa's teachings, and Buddhism, are the same. These truths were brought to your world by other people from outer space. It's a shame that throughout the ages and because of the separation of people, the ideas have changed so much. Remember, you and I are just two people from different parts of the universe. I'm in human form because I'm human, like you. I guess that's what you meant when you said I could go to my local library and find out about these things. I was reading a book recently, Gods and Spacemen in the Ancient West, which I thought was the greatest. It was the knockout punch to all my incredulity. After reading it, I was convinced that you people have come back. You've promised to return so many times, and now here you are, and very near the year 2000. Yes, and you haven't even started yet. When you get back to the United States, you'll have a lot of research to do. You're not going to take any major assignments, your missions will be short. Try to remember, you've promised us 2 years of your life. Now that I'm a member of your impossible mission team, will I get to go in one of your Vimanas, or flying saucers, or meet your friends? Yes, perhaps soon. When Rama said these words, I didn't say anything, but it was difficult to hide my excitement that she had finally agreed to let me investigate firsthand some of the things she'd been telling me. Naturally, she picked up on these thoughts. What's more important, Charles, is that we spend our time wisely. We're going to see each other at least 2 or 3 more times before you go back to the United States. I want you to come here as often as you can. You'll see how beautiful it's going to be. As we go along, we're going to be revising some of the teachings I've been discussing with you, okay? Okay, as you've already probably sensed, I'm completely convinced. My mind is made up. I want to, and must, write this message for you. Give me the proper guidance, and I'll complete the task. When do we start? As soon as you wish. How long will this take? How often am I going to come here? You will come when you have the time. We can cover a great deal in one session. It depends on how much we get off the subject and how eager you are to complete it. When am I going to be returning to the United States? Can you give me an exact date? Not an exact date, no. I told you I wouldn't interfere with your life. You just come here on weekends, or when you have the time, and we'll take it from there. At this point in the conversation, it was our turn to go into the bathhouses. We went in, never interrupting our conversation. She told me it would be easy to forecast when I would be returning to the United States, also that she could tell me the story of my life for the next few years, but that she would be destroying my incentive and, therefore, the joy of living. She said it would be kind of dull to know everything that was going to happen in the future, so I dropped the subject of the exact date I would be returning to the United States. Even though I hadn't seen Rama for a month, we were at ease with each other. My distrust of her and her motives had vanished. Instead, I felt a warmth and enthusiasm toward our relationship, because now we had one common goal. I was going to learn all she had to teach me, and she was ready and willing to start. I had stopped resisting, and discontinued my obnoxious behavior whenever she said something that frightened me. After our mineral bath, we decided to drive to a nearby town. It was early afternoon, kind of chilly and a little too cold to be out riding on a motorcycle. We took my car, and as we drove, we had a mind-to-mind conversation. Rama told me earlier that these mind-to-mind conversations meant that we didn't have to go through long explanations to understand simple concepts. From now on, she said, a thought, perhaps a glance, would explain something better than 1,000 words. I'll relate the mental conversation in words, although it's extremely difficult to translate in that mode, since visual images are equally important in this kind of conversation. Rama opened the discussion with the comment, "You're not the only person who's had experiences as incredible as you've had. There are other people who have published books, stating exactly the things I'm telling you. We all give the same messages to people with whom we come in contact, and by the time you're ready to publish yours, the time will be right for a change in attitude. Many of these strange things now going on here on this planet are just a fair warning from us to you, something pretty catastrophic is going to happen. If you want to be prepared to take a little trip with us, this is your chance. We're going to choose the people, good people, the type who have your kind of mentality. You'll see when you start doing your research. Look up a man by the name of George Adamski and start reading what he has published. You'll see that George Adamski, and many others, have also had contact with outer space beings. The time is ripe for us to make ourselves known, first to certain people, then with everyone through the establishment of media connections. There are many people in the world who are trying to stop this from happening. In one of his works, Adamski talks about the silent group which doesn't want our presence known. It's to their advantage to keep it as secret as possible. But since we gain nothing from this, We'll just start preparing for what is coming. That's the reason I've asked you to read the books of Daniel and Revelations and the 24th chapter of Matthew. Because they are accounts of angels, celestial armies, people coming in flying machines,